I tell you what, if there's any one passage that I felt the freedom to skip over and just kind of move on, it'd be this one tonight. This is a challenging passage in many ways, primarily because who wants to talk about celibacy or divorce or remarriage? I mean, none of these are interesting or helpful topics on the surface, and yet they're all things that we deal with. They're all things that either we've encountered personally or that others we love have had to wrestle and work through. And so Paul's giving answers to questions that have been asked him by the Corinthian church, and therefore he has to address even these most problematic and difficult issues. As I've told most of this group, 1 Corinthians I thought would be an easy book to go through, and I now am discovering it's one of the hardest of all, because every single chapter Paul's dealing with a problem. It is a problem-solving book, and that means everything he addresses is challenging. It involves a lot of nuance and pastoral care, and I think Paul is such the kind of person to address these issues both with sound theology, with a deep conviction of faith in Christ Jesus, and also a deep pastoral heart and affection for people, knowing that everyone's in a different situation and the kind of counsel he gives should have some flexibility to it. And you'll find that. We've already found that, but we'll find that as we continue through this book. We actually left off at chapter 6 last week, but I want to review those 6 verses because they really are a whole with the remainder of this section that we're going to look at tonight. So if you weren't here last week, this will be very, very quick. If you were here, hopefully it'll just be a refresher. Paul's answering questions. Verse 1. Now concerning the matters about which you wrote. It's at this point in his letter that he begins to answer the questions the Corinthian church had posed to him. Keep in mind, they're a 3-year-old church. Paul planted it. They're all young Christians. They have questions to this missionary pastor, and the letter has got to him. He's returning with these answers, and now he's addressing the specific questions they've posed. Their first question has to do with marriage, but they're stacking the deck by giving him this, "It is well for a man not to touch a woman." Apparently, included in their discourse with him, they had used a slogan, another Corinthian slogan. Much like if you look at chapter 6, verse 12, "All things are lawful for me." That was a cultural slogan or a Corinthian slogan. And Paul sees it and says, you know, that's half true, but it's not the whole truth. So he adds to it in verse 12, "All things are lawful, but not all things are beneficial." And he does that a number of times in that section there. Here he's given a slogan, but he can't add to it, because it is utterly and absolutely wrong. So he's going to oppose that statement, and he's going to oppose it by essentially saying in the rest of this paragraph that marriage is good, and sexual relations in a marriage are good. And you might wonder, why would Paul have to even address sexual relations in a marriage? Why would that even be an issue? Well, the reason it's an issue is because the Corinthians are under the influence of Platonic idealism, the idea that the body is a prison for the soul, that what the body does is largely irrelevant. What matters is one's soul. And there are two directions you can go when that kind of philosophy inundates your thinking or surrounds you in your culture. You can either indulge the body because what's done in the body doesn't matter, anything goes, and so whatever you do in your body, it really doesn't touch your spirit. And that's what's happened in 1 Corinthians chapter 6 that Paul addresses. Or you could do the opposite. You could seek to pacify the body. You could seek to be an ascetic in order to be more spiritual, renouncing physical pleasures in order to be more holy. You could go one of two directions. In the Corinthian church, Paul had both. He had some going the way of indulging. Chapter 6, he addresses that. Now he has some going the way of pacifying, not wanting to pollute their spirit and therefore trying to deny their body. And that's why Paul has to go out of his way to say sexual relationships in a committed relationship are good. And so verse 2, "But because of cases of sexual immorality, each man should have his own wife and each woman her own husband. The husband should give to his wife her conjugal rights, and likewise the wife to her husband. They have responsibilities to each other. For the wife does not have authority over her own body, but the husband does." And if you remember last week, if you stop there, that's Corinthian culture. That's Greco-Roman society. That's no big deal. He's not saying anything progressive or even Christ-like. But the next phrase, nobody in his time is saying. He's a true progressive in that he's just not mimicking his culture. He's actually saying, you know, the gospel points us to this direction too. Likewise, the husband does not have authority over his own body, but the wife does. And he gives a picture of mutual submission. He gives a picture where two partners are together and each one is supporting the other. He gives a picture where the husband has responsibilities to the wife to the husband. The husband, however, does not have authority over her. He instead must submit to her authority. She does not have authority when it comes to her body herself. She must submit to his authority. There's a mutual submission, which again is unheard of. And it's meant not to lead to any kind of power plays or sexual politics. It's not meant to lead to any kind of abuse where you owe me, your body's mine. It's instead meant to be this mutual submission of I owe you. Mine is yours. I am yours. You are mine. So Paul paints a beautiful picture of mutual relationship there. And then he says, sexual relations should be the norm. So, verse 5, do not deprive one another, except perhaps by agreement for a set time to devote yourselves to prayer, and then you may come together again so that Satan may not tempt you because of your lack of self-control. This I say by way of concession, not of command. Stop there. Paul doesn't command it. But he says, you know, if some of you want to fast from sex in a marriage, just like you'd fast from food or you'd fast from TV or you'd fast from chocolate, for a time you can do that. It's not commanded. It's a concession. It's something you could choose to do. But you better not make it any more than a time lest you be tempted because of your lack of self-control. Don't think that abstaining makes you more holy. It may make you more vulnerable to temptation. And so that's what Paul has to say about marriage. And we need to know that because he has to address another issue related to some who are wanting to seek divorce. Because one of the easiest ways to get out of having any kind of physical relations in marriage is just to divorce your partner. So he's going to address that. But before he does, he says something very odd. Something we don't hear much in our day. He commends celibacy. Verse 7. I wish that all were as myself am. So now if you get the pew, Bobby, you've turned the page. But each one has a particular gift from God, one having one kind and another different kind. So to the married, to the unmarried and the widows, I say that it is well for them to remain unmarried as I am. But if they're not practicing self-control, they should marry. For it is better to marry than to be aflame with passion. Now, Paul knows when he answers these questions, he's not just talking to married couples. He's talking to unmarried. He's talking to widows. He's talking to fiancés that have been set apart. Marriages have been arranged. And he's going to address every one of those different individuals throughout this chapter. So knowing in advance he's not just simply addressing married folk, he makes an aside and he talks about a group, verse 8, of the unmarried and the widows, and he places himself in that category. To the unmarried and the widows, I say it's well for them to remain unmarried as I am. The reason I want to point that out to you is this is the only place in any place in the New Testament where there's a small hint that Paul might have been married. Because he's putting himself in the camp of the unmarried and the widows. Now, it's all circumstantial evidence, but let me give you the evidence that people give. They will say it's exceptional, though not impossible, but it's very exceptional for Paul to have attained such a high status as a Pharisee of the Pharisees, a devout teacher of Torah and law, without having been married. That was nearly a prerequisite. And so they'll say, you know, in order for him to have achieved the kind of status he did prior to his conversion, that probably had to be likely. And so when you go down that route and then you see that Paul associates himself with the unmarried and the widows, this would be people who are outside of marriage at this point. Maybe they were married once, they're no longer married, and the widows, of course, are those who were married and now are widows. It's possible that Paul was a widower. It's possible that Paul had been married, but his conversion to Christianity was radical. And it might be that his wife left him. Or it's possible that he was never married at all. We just simply don't know. The circumstance, the evidence is entirely circumstantial. You couldn't build a case off of this. But it's interesting to note that Paul seems to want to place himself in this camp. And he says, you know, marriage is fine and good. He's already made that clear. Marriage is a wonderful thing. But now he wants to say, there's another good thing. There's not only one good thing. There are many good things. Too often we're so black and white we think only one thing can be good, and if marriage is good, well, to not be married must be bad. Or if celibacy is good, then to be married must be bad. We can't imagine a world of many possible goods, but Paul's very comfortable in that world, as I am. There are many possible goods, many possible ways for people to live because people are in different circumstances experiencing different things. Paul is well aware of that, and that's why it seems to be, for him to address this issue, he says, you know, you could take the easy route. If this is a really troublesome issue for you to wrestle with normal sexual relationships and a healthy, committed relationship, then you could not be in one at all. That's the route I've taken. It reduces the responsibilities I have, he'll say later, and it gives him a certain freedom. He's happy to live that way. He sees it as good, but he sees that it's not possible for everybody. He understands that celibacy is a good thing, but it's not the only good thing, so he doesn't preach his experience. I do my best not to preach my experience. You hear very little of, this is how I do it, you ought to do it like me. Because I screw up so much, the last thing I want to do is present myself as the model. I want to present Christ and the way of Christ and the assortment of ways that you could follow Christ with the different giftings you have. The odd way I have of being studious and, you know, enjoying these kind of studies is very odd. It's very obscure. It's very weird. The last thing I'd wish on any of you is to share that similar madness. Paul is not going to take his experience and say, hey, I find celibacy no problem, so why don't you? Instead, he says at the end of verse 7, each has a particular gift from God, one having one kind, another a different kind. He sees that he has a gift, and it's not for everyone. What he does think is for everyone is sexual purity. And so, because of that, he says, you know, if you are unmarried or you are a widow, if verse 9, you're not practicing self-control, well, you ought to put a ring on it. You ought to do something. You ought to marry. You ought to find an environment wherein you can exercise that without feeling guilty. Because it's better to marry than to be aflame with passion. The King James says it's better to marry than to burn. And unfortunately, many fundamentalist pastors will use that verse and say burn means burn in hell, even though Paul never uses that phrase to burn in hell. That's not his language. Jesus will say some things like that, but Paul does not. Instead, it's very obvious, and I think our translation gets it right. Paul says, you know, don't get so frustrated, burning with passion. Find the righteous outlet instead of being completely frustrated. Because if you don't have the gift of celibacy like I do, then you need to at least seek proper channels for which you can alleviate that. So now he's ready to move on because he's been talking about marriage. That was a little rabbit trail for him. And he wants to talk about the questions he's received about divorce. Because again, if you're living in a Platonic idealistic world and you want to keep your body denied so that your spirit can remain pure, one of the ways you might do that in a marriage is to say, you know, I'm just going to be done with this. I'll divorce, and then there won't even be that opportunity or option. And so one of the questions that must have been portrayed to him was, hey, some of us are wondering, should we stay or should we go? And Paul's not going to answer that. He's already partially answered that by saying marriage is good and sexual relationships and a committed relationship are good. He's already said that. So he's already partially addressed this, but now he's going to go full force and address particularly the question of should I stay or should I go? And that is a rock song, by the way, for anyone who needs. Okay, I'm glad some of you follow that because I try my best to throw in rock songs whenever I can. To really understand where Paul is going here, you need to understand divorce. Because marriage and divorce is different in different cultures. Do you realize that? In Jewish culture and in Greco-Roman society, here's what it took to get divorced. I'm leaving. And you're divorced. You're done. You didn't have to go through any state. You didn't have to, you know, work through any kind of public person. Your marriage was over. That's all it took. Now, some people would go to a judge to argue about a dowry, because, you know, money always tends to be the last thing we want to argue about. But you could, if you didn't have to worry about that, you didn't have much money, you could just say, I'm done, you're out of here. And both in Jewish society, all through the Old Testament, and in Greco-Roman society, you could simply say, I'm done with you, and you're out, and the marriage is over. Now, it was more common for upper-class families to go to the courts, and that, again, is because they had more money. It's also, again, because sometimes their marriages were arranged, because most marriages were arranged for political or financial advantage. And so they got to kind of work out how they're going to maintain their political or financial advantage while being divorced. So that's divorce in Greco-Roman society and in Jewish society. Divorce is also mentioned in the Torah. It's mentioned as something that is a reality. In Deuteronomy 24, 1 through 4, there's a case law given. If a man marries a woman who becomes displeasing to him because he finds something indecent about her, and he writes her a certificate of divorce, gives it to her, and sends her from his house, and if after she leaves his house, she becomes the wife of another man, and it goes on that, you know, if that man marries, that they can't get married again. It gets very convoluted and very hard to follow. But the point that you need to see is there is this reality of a certificate of divorce, and that officially ended the bond of marriage. If after she leaves, she becomes the wife of another man. It was assumed there was the openness or possibility of remarriage. None of that is up for contention. What is up for contention, and what was up for contention in Paul's day, in Jesus' day, and also in Paul's, is that particular phrase, what does it mean for the woman to become displeasing? Now, notice one other thing, because it's very patriarchal. The woman doesn't have the option here. Paul's going to give the woman free option in the passage we're about to read. But in the Torah, the woman is kind of at the mercy of the husband. So, going back to Torah, the question was, when does a woman become displeasing to a man? Well, there were two schools of thought. The rabbis loved to argue these case laws and try to work them out and come up with the one right answer. God help us trying to find the one right answer, other than it being Jesus. But that's not an answer, that's a person. But God help us. So there are, you know, people always arguing, what's the one right answer? And the school of Shammai had the answer that, okay, that displeasing quality is she's committing infidelity. She's an adulteress. She's cheated on him. Another school, Hillel, which was seen as more lenient, if she spoils a dish. If she's cooking his food and she burns his food, that's enough to make her displeasing. Now, yeah. Talk about petty. And yet that's what the rabbis would argue about. I mean, this was you read the Mishnah, the rabbinic arguments for different things, and they get exhausting because they get so petty because they're trying to find that one right answer. Jesus, when he comes on the scene, just a few decades before Paul, sides with one of those two. Guess who he sides with? Now, I'm not going to ask you to answer out loud, but if you didn't know any better, Jesus usually sides with the more lenient one. Except in this case, he doesn't. His disciples are quite flabbergasted in Matthew 19 when he sides with Shammai. When he says, I say to you, whoever divorces his wife and marries another commits adultery, but there is an exception. With the exception of infidelity or adultery. Because if that has happened, then that allows for there to be a legitimate right to divorce and to remarry. So Jesus sides with the stricter one. That shocks his apostles, but he does embrace that exception because it does take two, and if one person's not going to be true to their marital vows, it's pretty hard to maintain a faithful marriage. So this is the data that Paul has to work with. The problem with this data is Jesus was addressing a different culture. When Jesus speaks to people, guess what? They all share the same Jewish beliefs. They all share the same Jewish values. They all share the same Jewish culture. He can speak to people that are embracing common things, and so he can say certain things. But what do you do now that the gospel has gone into the Greco-Roman world? Other cultures are being brought in that think differently, that work differently, that act differently, and you're now having to address these same issues like divorce or marriage. What do? Do you just stick with Jesus and say Jesus had the final word? Well, Paul's not going to. Paul knows he has a tradition, but it's a tradition that must be modified because it's Catholic, small c. It's universal. It's something that can go out into the whole world. And so now he's going to address two scenarios, two situations where people are involved in marriages and they either are thinking about getting out or they're almost being forced to get out. His situation's different because guess who he is addressing? Not Jewish people with Jewish values and Jewish culture and Jewish respect for Torah. He's addressing Greco-Romans who are idolatrous, who don't share the same values. He's addressing people where one person might have been converted from the household and the rest remain unconverted. That would never happen. He's addressing households where the wife may have converted and the husband hasn't. She knows that she has freedom in Christ. He's still under the old patriarchy. I'll tell you what to do, woman, and you'll believe my gods, you'll follow my gods, you'll believe my way. He's got a totally different situation to address, this situation, this new situation of mixed marriages. Mixed marriages were seen as a big problem for Greco-Romans. Plutarch, he's writing in AD 140, but this still represents Greco-Roman culture. He writes in his advice to bride and groom, this is his words, "A wife ought not to make friends of her own, but to enjoy her husband's friends in common with him. The gods are the first and most important friends." Keep in mind, this isn't God, capital G, the creator. This is, you know, Mars and Venus and, whoever else you want to throw in this, Diana of Ephesus and whatever god is your chosen god. So the gods are the first and most important friends. "Wherefore it is becoming for a wife to worship and to know only the gods that her husband believes in and to shut the front door tight upon all other beliefs." Paul's addressing individuals in Corinth who are under this kind of oppression, that are being told, you're going to believe what your husband believes, even if now you're following Christ. You will stay still and be quiet. No, that's not what Paul says at all, as we look at this problem of mixed marriages. So the first divorce situation he addresses has to do with two believers, and the issue here wouldn't be the mixed marriage. The issue would be that they've decided that it's more sexually pure, it's more spiritual to be non-physical. And so maybe the easy way out is to go instead of stay. Verse 10, "To the married, I give this command, not I, but the Lord." So now he's going back to what Jesus says, that the wife should not separate from her husband, but if she does separate, let her remain unmarried or else be reconciled to her husband. Why? Because they're getting divorced for a dumb reason. Because, you know, they don't want to have normal sexual relationships. They've decided that's foul and fleshly and they want to be spiritual. They're going to quickly discover that that's not the solution. And that the husband should not divorce his wife. So, he uses Jesus' teaching here. We assume that he's still holding out if there's infidelity or adultery. Well, that makes for a different case. But if you're just going to do this so neither one of you has to be physically polluted by the other, then maybe you ought to stay unmarried because you don't have an idea really what this mutual submission and commitment to another is. But then he addresses the mixed marriage. And this he has more words for. "To the rest I say," and you ready? "I am not the Lord." Because he is now modifying the tradition. Jesus has given one exception. He's about to add another. Based on Jesus' tradition, but it must be modified in light of the new scenario, the new culture, the new reality of mixed marriages. And so he says, "I am not the Lord, that if any believer has a wife who is an unbeliever, and she consents to live with him, he should not divorce her. And if any woman has a husband who is an unbeliever and he consents to live with her, she should not divorce him. And so if there's consent, if they're willing to accept this conversion, if they're willing to embrace them as they are, if they're willing to go along with them and allow them to have their faith, either the wife, which would be harder, or the husband, he says, this isn't a reason to divorce. And here's why, and this is the amazing reason he gives. Verse 14, for the unbelieving husband is made holy through his wife. He's sanctified. He is set apart. He's in a different situation than your average pagan. And the unbelieving wife is made holy through her husband. Otherwise, your children would be unclean, but as it is, they are holy. Paul says, you know, don't rush to divorce, particularly if your partner will stay with you, because the reality is you have more of a positive influence than they have a negative on you. You have the capacity to bring Christ and sanctification and grace, not only to your children, which we'd assume any good parent would want to pass on. They'd want to pass on their faith and what they value to their children, but even to their unbelieving spouse. And so they might be afraid that the unbelieving spouse would pollute them. Paul says, no, it's the other way around. You're going to sanctify them. You're actually bringing a sanctifying, holy presence to the situation. So if they're willing to tolerate that, then it's better for them. They're actually getting the better end of the deal. But that's not always going to be the case, that the unbeliever in a mixed marriage will be happy to stick along. And that's why in verse 15, Paul then gives this further counsel. But if the unbelieving partner separates, that is, they want a divorce, let it be so. In such a case, the brother or sister is not bound. They're not bound to the covenant. They're not bound to that marriage. Why? It is the peace that God has called you. The partner will stay. It's good for them. They'll benefit. If they want to separate, Paul tells the people, don't fight it. You're not bound. God's called you to peace. Don't feel the pressure that you've got to make this work, or that somehow you're a lesser person, or your faith is somehow void or null because you can't just stick through this. Instead, know that you're free, because God's called us to peace, and peace is always two ways. It involves both people seeking to be reconciled and together and to be in harmony. And if that can't happen, since it's a two-way street, then don't fight it. But then he adds this last little bit, and I don't know why he does. Some people say it's because he's trying to be a little optimistic. Me, being the morbid person I am, think he's being realistic and not optimistic. He says, wife, for all you know, you might save your husband. Husband, for all you know, you might save your wife. So that some people read that and say, this is Paul just giving some little positive, you know, pep talk. Why doubt the influence that you'll bless your family? You know you're going to do it. You're going to bless them. I think Paul is actually being realistic. He's essentially encouraging, you never know. So if you can tolerate it and they don't want to leave, you're going to bring a sanctifying presence. Some good may come out of this, but you also never know. You can't assume some good will. It may not. You don't know. So he gives the hope of the possibility that some good might come if their partner is willing to endure them. But he also then makes it clear that that's not always the case. They've got a choice to make. They aren't just automatically saved. They instead have a sanctifying presence. But it's up to them. And you may have a positive influence. You may not. Either way, they're not going to pollute you. You will end up sanctifying them. They're in a better position. Now, Paul's going to move on in verse 17, and this is where we'll pick up next week when he says, hey, wherever you are in life, you can bloom where you're planted. It's such a wonderful passage. He's going to talk about oftentimes our dreams are, if I could only be here, if I only could have that person, or if I only could have this amount of money, or if I only could have that job, I'd really bloom. But Paul says, no, you bloom where you're planted, right where you are right now. We'll talk about that next week, because it has some connections to some of the people in a mixed marriage that might be questioning, do I stay? Do I go? My partner's not resistant, so maybe some good should come. Can some good come? Paul wants to underscore that even further. But before we look at that next week, Lord willing, I want to give you, as I always do, three reflections from this passage. One is most important, and I've already alluded to all of these, but Paul modifies the tradition. Jesus says things, and what Jesus says has ultimate authority. But the church historically, and Paul here, uniquely, right at the beginning of the Christian movement, has no problem taking the words of Jesus and saying, Jesus didn't say a word about this, so I'm going to have to modify the tradition. I am not the Lord. He's going to do his best to assess it in light of the gospel, in light of Christ, but he's going beyond what Jesus said because he's forced to. He's in a situation where the rules in which Jesus worked no longer apply. Now, I can tell you every culture has to wrestle with that at some level and on some degree. To wrestle with where do we modify tradition? At what point have we modified it to the point of voiding it? At what point have we modified it so that we're actually enhancing it? We're actually moving it forward so that the faith truly can be Catholic. It can grow like a weed in any culture. When are we modifying it too much? When are we compromising it? Those are very difficult issues to wrestle with. But Paul's doing it here, and he at least gives us a model. He knows that new circumstances call for new readings. Jesus gave one exception, adultery. Paul adds a second. It's in verse 15. It's the one that theologians call desertion. That if the spouse abandons the other, they do not want to be faithful to the vows. They do not want to participate any longer in their end of the bargain. That's called desertion. And Paul says, stay if you're a believer, if they'll tolerate you, but if they won't, then you're free. And so Paul's going to add to that adultery desertion. Now, what I find wonderful about Paul's position is he takes sin seriously. Adultery's sin. It's evil, it's wicked, it hurts people. Desertion is sin. It's evil, it's wicked, it hurts people. He takes sin seriously. We're not taking sin seriously if we say to someone, stick with it no matter what they do. No matter how they act, no matter how they behave. We're not taking sin seriously anymore. We're overly sanctifying marriage and making it like that's the holiest thing, so just grudgingly stick through it. Paul sees that there are some real sins, and he's also realistic enough to know it takes two to maintain a relationship. You can't maintain it if one is going to be unfaithful, either through adultery or through desertion. So Paul adds another exception. I think in our day, we could easily add at least one more exception. And you probably know what it is. It's probably been something you've been thinking since I started talking about this. Abuse. If there's physical abuse, that, boom, that's it. Now, you could choose to try to work it out and wrestle with it, but don't feel like you have to, because at that point, the vows have been broken. So I think that there are things that Paul never mentions that we in our culture might have to say, you know, that still fits with taking sin seriously, understanding it takes two, and understanding that, you know, there's one exception with Jesus, another with Paul, there may be others. And I think at least physical abuse would qualify in that category. There may be others, but you'd want to think through this, you'd want to work through it, and you want to make sure that you're modifying the tradition, you're allowing it to evolve and to shape itself within our new cultural environment, and not nullifying and voiding it and making it so that we don't have a tradition at all. The tradition grows. It's alive. It's not just a museum piece. And so I find it amazing that Paul does this. He feels free to modify the tradition, and he challenges us in how we might have to sometimes morph our tradition to fit within our cultural constraints and cultural environment. Second thing that I want to highlight here in Reflections is God's call to peace. At the end of verse 15, he says, it is to peace that God has called you. And Paul and Jesus are astute and realistic enough to know that peace takes two. We studied Romans a few months back, and in Romans 12, Paul says, if it is possible, as far as it depends on you, live at peace with everyone. You know why I like that? If it's possible. As far as it depends on you. Who's the responsibility on? It's on us as the hearers. But Paul's realistic enough to say, it may not be possible. He then moves on and says, whatever you do, don't take vengeance. That's never, ever allowed. Vengeance is mine, says the Lord. It's not ours to give, even though all the movies we watch will tell us it is ours to give. It's not ours to give. Instead, if it's possible, blessed are the peacemakers. But you can't make peace with one person. Jesus will say the same thing when he sends his disciples out. He sends out the 12 in Matthew 10. If anyone will not welcome you or listen to your words, shake off the dust from your feet as you leave that house. Move on. Get over it. God's called you. Just move on. You've got a gospel of peace. If there's going to be no acceptance of it, if they're going to spurn you, despise you, move on. There'll be other places you can go. And of course here, when Paul says in verse 15, if the unbelieving partner wants nothing to do with you, separates, let it be so. In such a case, the brother or sister is not bound. It is to peace that God's called you, because you can't make peace with one. So God's call to peace, I think, is important. Now note, this is where our culture gets it wrong. God's call to peace is not our own self-actualization, or our own fulfillment, or our own happiness. So, you know, eat, pray, love. Well, I decided to divorce my husband just because I wanted to go eat, pray, love. I mean, I some of you might like that book. If you do, more power to you. I find it just abhorrent that she just decides, the guy's not adulterous, he's not unfaithful, I'm just going to divorce him. Got other things to do. It's like, what? What? What's wrong with this picture? And why is this book so popular? But I could ask that about 50 Shades of Grey and other things. So you have this reality that it's not our happiness, our self-actualization, our self-fulfillment. It's peace with God. It's knowing God. It's being able to live a life in harmony with the Christ that you're seeking to follow, and knowing that part of living at peace with God will cause people to turn against you. Father, mother, brother, sister, I'll separate households, Jesus says. I come bringing a sword. It'll divide. The people within their own household will be divided against one another. That coming to Jesus and following Jesus sometimes doesn't lead to everyone being blissfully, peacefully reconciled. Sometimes it leads to challenge and to sometimes loss of relationship. There are friends of mine from the past that want nothing to do with me for one reason and one reason only. I'm a Christian. That's it. Nothing else, because I'm exactly the same. Otherwise, I like the same music. I'd drink a beer with them. I'd go have fun with them. But hey, I'm this weird Christian guy now. And you got to be, you know, like a nutcase to be a Christian. And so has to be something wrong with you. Finally, sanctifying presence. I think this is such a wonderful picture in verse 14. The unbelieving husband is made holy through the wife. What you have here is Paul developing Jesus' ability to turn the food laws, the laws of purity, on their head. Do you remember Jesus' ministry, how he would eat with the unclean and the outcast, and how against the law he would touch the lepers, even though the law said, don't you dare touch a leper? Or he would touch the woman with the issue of menstruation, even though the Torah specifically says you do not touch a woman during that time. How Jesus completely and utterly opposed those and said, I declare all foods clean. Jesus had a real issue with the purity laws, because in his mind, with the coming of the Spirit and the dawn of the new age in him as the Messiah, it's not that other things made us unclean. It is that he was, if you will, casting purity on everything he touched. He was bringing holiness to it. He was bringing presence. He wasn't defiled by the leper. He was sanctifying the leper. He wasn't defiled by the woman with the issue. He instead was communicating peace and love. That's an important thing to keep in note, because Paul really believes in that sanctifying presence. And later, when we get to 1 Timothy, Paul's going to directly address this Platonic idealism when he talks about false teachers who forbid people to marry and order them to abstain from certain foods which God created to be received with thanksgiving by those who believe and know the truth. Why, Paul says? For everything created by God is good, and nothing is to be rejected if it's received with thanksgiving. Creation is good. Marriage is good. Sex is good. Food is good. Taste buds are good. Defecation is good. Peeing is good. Bouncing on a trampoline is good. Listening to music is good. I mean, you could just go on. And isn't it true there are some within our Christian family that actually look at things and say, that's defiled. They look at God's good creation and say, that's defiled, and I can't touch it or it'll defile me. And Paul says, you know, that's just never the way to go. There's a sanctifying presence. He'll move on in Titus as he's addressing another pastor. To the pure, all things are pure, but to the corrupt and unbelieving, nothing is pure, which is to say, it's not impure things that make men impure. It is impure men who make every pure thing impure. Now, we'll talk about that more when we get into Paul's letters, but my big point with this sanctifying presence is don't be fearful. You're not going to move into a house or go somewhere and all of a sudden some kind of unclean defilement is going to contaminate your life and now you're just a mess. You bring holiness wherever you go, in whatever you do. You bring God's likeness, God's love, God's presence, God's grace. And that power is far greater than anything that you're being confronted by. We should be fully aware that we do not need to fear anything, for we bring the sanctifying presence of the Spirit everywhere we go. We bring, if you will, the portable altar. And the portable altar is the altar of our lives upon which we are making our lives a living sacrifice. And that portable altar is making holy everything it contacts with. So please don't be fearful. Don't think that somehow we're going to be defiled or polluted. If we understand Jesus' teaching and Paul's allusion here rightly, we understand that we bring a sanctifying influence to everything we do. Would you pray with me?